Hey, yous, my name is Bruce. I'm an alcoholic. I hope yous all enjoyed the New York cuisine tonight. I know after that pastrami and the corned beef, you'll never go back to chicken and grits again. Yeah. Come on, bring it. I ain't afraid. Anyhow, this guy I'm going to introduce to you is him and I traveled the same circles up north before I come down here. We might even have been on a couple of motorcycle rides together. He rode out of Saratoga. I rode out of a place a little further north than that. But I know we know the Goat Brothers and some of the other clubs. But anyhow, this guy's got a great recovery, and I'm really proud to be up here to introduce him. And Larry T, come on up here, brother.
Hello. I'm Larry. I'm an alcoholic. Can you hear me in the back? All right.
What?
It's good to be here. Man, a lot of people here tonight. I didn't think all you people liked me. Food's amazing. Kind of reminds me of home. I'm Larry. I'm an alcoholic, and I feel like this thing should be closer for some reason. But my sobriety date's May 28, 1990. I got sober in New York. I had the same home group for 22 years. Old sobriety up there, boy. I tell you, them guys didn't play with you. They were really kind of mean and nasty, and I didn't like them. I didn't like anybody when I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, including myself. I come from a family of disease of alcoholism. My grandfather was an alcoholic. My grandmother was an alcoholic. My father was an alcoholic. My brothers and sisters were alcoholics. My aunts and uncles were alcoholics. My neighbors were alcoholics. My friends were alcoholics. I was an alcoholic. Actually, I was a drug addict, tell you the truth. There's some drugs in my story, so bear with me, okay? I grew up the youngest of five kids, you know. Lived with my grandmother, Irish, Catholic, you know, and everybody in my family went to Catholic school except me. I did go to church, and I was an altar boy. But I got caught stealing, and I remember the priest told my father it'd probably be better if I went to public schools, and I took a whipping for that. I took a lot of beatings. My father was a very abusive man. He beat us kids, beat my mother. My youngest recollection of a child is my mother sitting me on the kitchen table so he wouldn't punch me while he was punching her. A lot of abuse, and. And I was scared most days and most nights. I had two brothers that went off to Vietnam in the 60s. When my brother came home in 1968, he introduced me to drugs. I was 9 years old. And I started shooting heroin when I was 12. I had serum hepatitis when I was 14. And I did drugs until I was 30. And I didn't think I was an alcoholic, and that's what kept me out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I come in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1985. There's a story behind that. Let me go back a little bit to my teenage years. Even before that, the family used to have these gatherings, weddings and funerals and stuff like that, and everybody would get together and my mother would get me one of them little Shirley Temples, you know, with the grenadine and ginger ale. And I used to get mad because they wouldn't put liquor in it. And I wanted to drink with the big people, you know. Even as a little kid, I wanted to do that. So when the opportunity arose, I did that. And, I lived up to my heritage, by the way. I was a good alcoholic, man. I really was. I could drink. And, you know, when we were hanging out in the neighborhood, back then the drinking age was 18, and when I was 15, I had this little mustache going here that I kept my whole life, and I could drink in the bars. I could get in the bars. People at the liquor store, though, knew the family, and they knew I was the youngest, and they wouldn't sell me any liquor, so I'd have to get my buddies and my brothers and their friends to buy me booze, and I was partial to peppermint schnapps. And I didn't get no pint or half pint or nothing. I got me a freaking bottle of that stuff, you know, the fifth or whatever that big thing is. And we'd go up to the park and drink, a bunch of us. And everybody would pass out, and I'd still be drinking. And I'd drink all their drinks. And I did that a lot. I knew that if I could hang out and stick it out long enough, everybody's going to pass out, and they're going to leave their booze, and I'm going to drink that shit. And I did, you know. People started getting wise and started hiding stuff on me and stuff. I had to go scavenger hunting for it, but I'd find it, you know. But I drank all through my teens and into my 20s and stuff. And I met my first wife. I was 22. She was 21. And she was going to school to be an engineer, and I was working as a lineman at that time, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. I did transmission work. Before that, though, my life was all criminal, by the way. I need to tell you this, okay? My mother come from a family of 14, 7 boys and 7 girls. And I got 3 uncles, well, 2 uncles and a cousin. I always thought he was my uncle, but I found out later as I grew up he was my cousin. We're bank robbers. There's some history on that. You can look on the net. They're there. My cousin, who I thought was my uncle, was in the witness protection program because he stole $30 million from the mob, and so they wanted to kill him. And I had 2 aunts that my mother used to ship me off to Boston when I was a kid in the summertime to get me out of trouble and stuff, and spending with my aunts and uncles and my cousins up there. And I had 2 aunts that would give me all my clothes for school in the fall. And I thought they were rich. I really did. As I got older, I found out that they were kleptomaniacs. And I'm serious. I mean, they stole from people used to give them their Christmas lists, and they go shopping for them. And that's how it was. My aunt, her whole bedroom was lined with clothes. And they would get, you know, shuffleboards. They'd get anything you wanted. It was amazing. And years down the road, when I got older, I used to rent my car for $100 a day. That was good money, too. But it was all about making money. I remember making money. I mean, my old man was, he had a little stuff going on in the neighborhood. You know, he would take bets, and he would give me a paper bag, and I'd take it up to this door and ring the bell, and the guy would come down and give him the bag. He'd give me $20, and I didn't know it. I was running numbers for him. I didn't know that shit, So it was all criminal stuff, and I stole when I was younger. I braked into places, and I robbed cars, and, you know, we went to a Cadillac dealer one night to break in and steal the keys out of the building to steal the cars in the parking lot, and I realized that there was keys in the car in the showroom, and I drove the car right through the glass doors and stole the car. Used to do stuff like that. It was crazy, insane stuff, man. You know, that was my life, you know, and made a lot of money illegally, did a lot of drugs and a lot of drinking, and I didn't realize that drinking was an issue. I really didn't. I thought I was a junkie. I was brought up in drugs and alcohol, but drugs were my profession. I did it really well. And when I came in 85, I had an issue with that because I didn't consider myself an alcoholic. I didn't consider myself a junkie, and I was comparing and instead of relating. And I didn't get sober in '85. I didn't get sober until 1990. And the way that went about, by 1990, I'm getting old. I'm forgetting the dates here, but I became a fireman in New York, And my disease really was crazy. I was married, had a house upstate, wife and a kid, and I woke up one day and realized I had to be an adult, and I didn't want to do that. And, and I really started using and drinking really heavy, and it was getting in the way of my job. I was putting people at risk. I was putting myself at risk. I got blown down an attic stairwell one night, me and my partner, in a flashover because I was fucked up and didn't realize what was going on, and I wanted to go back up. Come on, let's go do some more. He's like, you're insane, dude. But you know, in that trade, when there's a fire, most people run out and leave everything behind. And you know, some of these places I went to, I used to cop dope from, so I knew there was dope in there, money, and I would go in there and steal their money and their dope. And restaurants and bars that caught on fire, I'd always put a couple of bottles in my coat when I left, and you know, make sure I got top shelf stuff. And you know, that's the way it was. And here I was supposed to be a member of society, and I was the worst part of society. You know, and I did a lot of nasty, nasty stuff, and it took me a long time to get through it all. But anyways, in 1990, it came about. My wife had enough of my stuff and threw me out. And you know, I've been in back and forth with Family Court, and that's how I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous in '85. Judge recommended that. Well, my first wife asked the judge that I be evaluated. I had a drug and alcohol problem. And he sent me to this guy, John Evans, who's dead now, to be evaluated. And John, he gave me a really good evaluation. You know, he told the judge that I was an alcoholic and drug addict. And when I went back to court, you know, I knew the system. I asked the judge for a second opinion because the guy didn't have an MD at the back of his name. And he had to give me the second opinion, so I went and seen a doctor that was an alcoholic. And he told the judge that I wasn't an alcoholic, that I had a slight problem with drugs, but not alcohol. So I got away from that one, too, in '85. And, you know, before that, you know, and I'm going to backtrack again here. In 1980, I got hit my bike in Boston. I spent my 21st birthday in the hospital. I spent 3 months in there, and they shoot me up with drugs, Demerol, morphine every 3 hours. I left that hospital after 3 months of being shot up with dope. And the judge or the doctor said, I asked for some medicine to go home with. And he said, you got a long history of drug and alcohol abuse. I'm sure you can find it on the street. See, that's the way my life was, okay? And I did. I had it by the time I got home. My buddy's brother died of cancer. I had the morphine, liquid morphine. I had a bag of Valium, a case of Budweiser, and a bottle of Jack. That's all I needed, you know, myself medicating. Before that, when I was 18, they had me on Anabuse. I was trying to drink with that. Not a good thing. Make you sick as a dog. But that was my disease, and I didn't know it. Okay. But in 1990, my wife threw me out of the house. I took a little vacation from the firefighting profession and tried to get my shit together. I went down to Florida where my sister lives in Jacksonville, and I was at the end of my rope. There was nothing left. My family was in the shitter. My job was in the shitter. My life was in the shitter. Spent all the money I had. I had $35 in my pocket, and I was going to go to the pawn store down the street and buy a Saturday night special with that $35 and put a bullet in my head that day. And I was going to do it, too. I was done. For some reason, and here's where the God thing comes into my life. God's always been with me, and I didn't know it. He saved me through a lot of stuff, got me through a lot of stuff. And I didn't know it because I didn't know God. I didn't know who He was. And there was a commercial on TV in my sister's the room, and I can see it just as vivid as standing here between you guys tonight. Said if you had a problem with drugs and alcohol, call this number. I was a blackout drinker now, okay? I mean, I've been a blackout drinker my whole life. I called the number, and a little while later, there was a horn beeping out front. It was a taxi cab, and I went out there, asked the guy, you know, in my typical attitude, what the hell do you want? Of course, I didn't use that language. And he said, you Larry? And I said, yeah. He said, you called the number, and I'm here to pick you up. And I said, what number? And he said, the crisis line. All right, let's check it out. So his name was Gus. Gus was my angel that God sent me. Gus gave me a ride from the west side of Jacksonville, Florida, to the east side of Jacksonville, Florida. If some of you have been in Jacksonville, you know it's pretty long ways. And I was watching the meter go tick, 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 and it was going up. It got up to about $45, and I was thinking to myself, oh, poor Gus, man, I gotta punch this guy and jump out of his cab. he's not getting my last $35, man. It ain't happening, you know what I mean? And I was gonna do it, too. But, and I told him on the way back home, by the way, I was gonna whip his ass. But all Gus did was drive for this crisis unit. He picked up alcoholics and drug addicts and took them there and back, and they paid for the cab ride. Make a long story short, I talked to the people there and told them that I've been introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I think I would use the word I was in recovery in New York. I found out later I wasn't. Told them what was going on with my life and how I was and the way I was real honest with them, man, because it was the end anyways. I didn't care. I didn't care anymore. And the lady said, maybe you should go back to New York, because that's where it sounds like your family and all your support network and treatment is for you. It'd be a good thing if you start there. So I called home when I got back to my sister's and talked to my ex-wife. She's my ex by now. But she said, if you promise not to drink on the way home, I'll talk to your mom and we'll put some money together and get you a ticket and get you home. And I promised I wouldn't. And I didn't. I flew back home and I went and seen John Evans again. John was another angel that God put in my life that I didn't realize at that point in time. And John said, I'll get you in. He wanted, from 85 until 90 now, realized that he wanted me to go into some treatment, and I kept refusing because, for one, if you found out what I did, you'd know I'm crazy and you're going to lock me the fuck up, okay? It's going to happen. I knew that. So I kept, refusing to do that. And when I went and seen him, he said, I want to send you to a 28-day program. And I said, okay. Well, I went back home and he called me and he said, there's not a bed available. As soon as a bed becomes available, we'll get you in. I said, it ain't going to happen, man. I'm going to drink. I'm going to drug. I know how I am. I can't stay away from the people, places, and things. I've been doing it my whole life. I'm going to use if you don't lock me up somewhere, put me away. So my wife at the time decided she was going to take me to a mother's house, which was in Rensselaer Falls, New York, which is just outside of Ogdensburg, New York, which is on the St. Lawrence Seaway, which if you throw a rock, you can hit Canada. Okay, that's how far north it is. To get me away from all that stuff. And we were leaving on Friday. They called and said, Thursday, if you can be there Friday, we have a bed for you at Hamilton Hall in Ogdensburg, New York. And I'm like, you're shitting me, right? It's God again. See, I didn't know any of that stuff then, that God was working in my life. And so we went up there, and we drove into this place, and there was a big sign out front that said, Welcome to St. Lawrence County Psychiatric Center. And I said, I knew it. It's where they house the criminally insane, all right? There's a bunch of prisons there and shit. I mean, it's a bad place. But that's where the rehab was. And I spent 2 months and 2 days in a 28-day program up there. I was diagnosed in late stages of drug and alcohol abuse. I had liver problems, sugar problems. I couldn't read a chapter out of the big book and remember it. And I was a wreck. I couldn't eat anything. I was really, really sick. And I thought maybe if I went there that they were going to show me how to do it right. That was my thought in the back of my head. They're going to teach me how to drink a drug right. I'm going to learn all about this stuff. And the time that I spent there, I did learn about it. I learned about what the disease does to the family, to the nervous system, to the brain, to the organs, to the job, to all aspects of my life. I learned. And I left there, and I went right into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been here ever since. And that's where it brings me to you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. In recovery, early in recovery, I didn't have a clue. I didn't know anything. I didn't understand what people were talking about. I couldn't talk. I didn't know how to express myself. I couldn't find the words to tell you that I was hurting. So the only thing I could use was my anger, because that's what I used my whole life. That's what my shield and my sword and my walls were all built out of, was anger. And I used it to my advantage many, many times, and I knew how to do it. I could look at people and find your insecurities and use them against you. I really could, you know. I knew how to, my body language would work. I knew how my voice would work. I knew how my looks would work. I knew how I dressed would work. And I would intimidate the shit out of people. And I got here, and I was 2 years sober before somebody came up and said, I think you're starting to get the program. People would get up and move away from the table when I came in and sat down, because I was just that angry. All right? People would try to give me suggestions, and I would look at them and go, you don't fucking know me. Don't talk to me. Stay away from me. Leave me alone. And they did. And I didn't get the help I needed. That's sad. That's real sad. But that's the way I was. See, I was brought up, never ever tell anybody what's going on in the family. Don't let them cry. Don't let them see you cry. You know? Never ever admit to something, because if you do, you're going to jail. All those things I was taught were wrong, wrong, wrong. And I didn't know any different, because that's the way I was taught. You know what I mean? So I came in here and I had to learn how to live over again. And Alcoholics Anonymous, and I say this a lot, is the only place I know of that you can actually get a second chance in life. And you can do it the right way this time. You know, you can. So, you know, back then growing up, seeing all the stuff I seen, doing all the stuff I did, saying the stuff I did, I knew was wrong. All right. You know, I was a racist, sexist, chauvinist pig. Okay? I didn't give a shit about anybody, including myself. And I used that. I mean, I used all that stuff. So to come in here and all of a sudden I have to admit to something, I have to be willing to change, you know, I have to find a higher power. I got to tell somebody about my past. Man, that's some big stuff. That's some big stuff for somebody that doesn't want anybody to know who he is, you know. So I had to take a risk. And risks are a part of my sobriety. I love telling on myself, by the way. See, because if I don't tell you what's going on with me, you can't help me. And I just told you why. I just told you why. Because that's the way I was. And I didn't get the help the first time I was here. That's why it took me 5 years to get sober. That ain't right, man. If you're thinking like that, you're thinking wrong. Thinking wrong. You know, if you're early in recovery here, open up, take the risk, face your fears. You know, I got a lot of fears, believe it or not. You know, in the time I've been here, I've not only done a lot of work inside the rooms, I've done a lot of work outside the rooms. I've sought a lot of help. I've been in a lot of treatment. You know, with John, a guy named Walter Finnegan. I've done work with John Lee and Robert Bly and John Bradshaw outside of this room, workshops. You know, I had to go to college and take a parenting class because I didn't know how to be a parent. See, my old man was an abuser and a drunk, a womanizer. And, you know, my grandfather died, his name was forbidden to be spoken in the house ever again. That's how mean and nasty he was. And I didn't know him. He died before I was young, before I was born. But, you know, all those things, you know, made me take a look and change. And I wanted to change. I wanted to change even when I was out there using, because I knew it was wrong. When I was in high school, and the coaches would be like, dude, you got so much potential, man. Why don't you stop doing what you're doing? You don't know where I came from. You don't know where I got to go every night. You know what I mean? You know, I'm selling dope out on the field, man. You know, I'm drinking in the locker room. You know, I couldn't handle life. You know, I didn't know what to do. So I come in here, and all those old timers, man, took a hold of me. And they said, hang on, kid, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. Just don't drink, man. Change the people, places, and things. I was like, wow, that's my life, man. I don't know anything other than. I was scared to death. See, I knew who the alcoholic and drug addict Larry was. I knew how the society and the streets handled that guy. But the clean and sober guy, who is this guy? I never met him. I don't know him. Who is he? What's he going to become? That's scary stuff, man. You know? Then you start doing work on the inside, right? You know, I heard in the rooms that if you're not working within, you're working without. There's a reason for that. It's all that stuff inside that I carry that's made me drink. It's made me use. You know? I have to work on that stuff. So I started doing that. And all of a sudden, people like that lady that came up to me 2 years sober and said, I think you're starting to get it. Started asking me to speak, sponsor. You wanna do some service work? Here's the keys. Make some coffee. I'm like, oh man, you know what I mean? So, my spiritual side. I'm a very spiritual man. You know, I get up every morning and I meditate and pray and I pray throughout the day. I never pray for myself though. I always pray for other people and other things. So. That's the difference. See, I used to have those foxhole prayers. Get me out of this one, man. I'll never do it again. Yeah. Don't let them find out. I'll never do it again. You know? Yeah. I don't do that anymore. But, you know, how I became spiritual, and this is very important. My first wife was a Protestant. I married her in a Baptist church. She was a Methodist. I married her in a Protestant church. We became a Baptist. I was brought up a Roman Catholic, and I found out a few years back my grandmother was Jewish. So, I'm trying to cover all the bases here. Man. Yeah, fucking good alcoholic. You know, let's take it to the extreme. But when I wanted to become spiritual, the reason why I became a Baptist is because. I was driving down the road, and there's a bunch of churches, you know, Catholic church here, Protestant church there, Baptist church, Methodist church, they're all over the place. And I knew I wasn't going to turn in that parking lot when they're Catholic churches, because I've done that stuff before. So I took a right and pulled into the Baptist church. I went and talked to the pastor in there. His name was Phil Lister. He's dead, too, now. Seems like all the people around my life early on have been gone. But I went in, and I would sit down and talk to him, you know, and he'd invite me in. We'd sit, and you know, I told him I'm reading the Bible, I'm in recovery, and I'm trying to get spiritual, and I'm trying to figure out this stuff, spirituality, because it's a spiritual program. And we talk about the Bible and the stories in the Bible and everything, and I would come off the wall with some stuff, you know what I mean? Jesus, man, this guy, I mean, he's been around, man. You know, he's done a lot of stuff. You know, I'm not too sure he's done all that stuff. I mean, these stories were told by the 12 disciples, and, you know, those guys were drinking, and, you know, they're partying. I can exaggerate a pretty good story myself, you know what I mean? And it's been 2,000 years, these stories have been told and told and told and told and told. Phil would laugh, man. He'd look at me and go, wow. That was a challenge for him, too. I bet you they didn't tell him that in college when he became a pastor. But Phil said to me one thing, and this is what... this is what made me spiritual. This is what turned the point for me, made the light come on. We were sitting there one day, and I was going over a bunch of stuff, you know, my doubts. And he said, it's okay to doubt, Larry. Doubt all you want. He said, because by doubting, you find the answers you're looking for. He said, but I got to ask you a question. And I said, okay, what's this one? He goes, if there is a heaven and there is a God, in the day of reckoning before you're standing before him, do you want to be wrong? And I said, no, I don't want to be wrong. You know, that's the day I became spiritual. I accepted Jesus Christ into my life. And my sobriety changed. It really did. I started looking at things a lot differently. I started realizing that God had put all these miracles before my eyes, but I could not see them. You know, John Evans, the cab driver, all these things that were going on in my life. The times that I OD'd and didn't die, all the blackouts that I wake up in other states and other places and not dead. Those were miracles that God were performing, and I didn't realize it, you know what I mean? And when my eyes got open and I started realizing what was going on around me, I started seeing the miracles in the rooms. And you've heard me say, I see them every day. It's all you newcomers that come in the rooms and the people that I know that are still in the rooms that I've watched and witnessed change their lives before my eyes. That's a true miracle. That's a blessing that God has opened my eyes up enough to realize that the miracles are before me, and where I was looking wasn't the right places. The blessings that he's bestowed upon me, my children, the things that I've seen and come through in recovery. And we'll tell you about those things right now, okay? Let me start at 5 years sober, okay? When I was 5 years sober, I almost drank. I didn't. AA saved me. When I was 11 years sober, I almost drank. I didn't. When I was 10 years sober, my mother died on my 10th AA birthday, May 28th. I left the hospital and I went to my home group and celebrated my 10 years sobriety. Everybody's like, man, your mother just died. Well, you should be here. You should be there. Why are you here? Because AA gave my mother back her son. And she told me never stop doing what I'm doing. Yeah. I was 12 years sober. I was in a workshop, an anger to forgiveness workshop. I talk about this all the time because this was amazing. This is another eye-opener for me, for God. And they were talking about, there was 15 guys in a circle, men's retreat. And everybody's going around talking about their anger, and this guy next to me is like, yeah, you know, I've hit women, I've slapped them, been arrested for abuse and battery. And it got to me, and I was like, I never hit a woman. And the guy, B.C. Cheney, his name is, a really good friend of mine, by the way. B.C. was a really good guy, and he still is, actually. He said, you never hit a woman, Larry? I said, no. My father used to beat us and beat my mother and beat my sisters. And my youngest recollection is my mother set me on the table when I was a baby so he wouldn't punch me when he was punching her. And by the way, I went to school when I was 4, and that was before I went to school. So I was like 3 years old, and I still remember that to this day, and I'm 55. And he said, you never hit a woman? No. I'm proud. I never hit my chest is out. I'm never hit no women. He said, can I ask you a question? I said, yeah. He said, how do you talk to women? I said, I'll talk to women any fucking way I want to. What do you do when you get mad? Tell them to get the F away from me and leave me alone. He said, you're the worst kind. You're a verbal abuser. That stays with the mind forever. My father was a verbal abuser too, and I didn't realize that. He would abuse us verbally before he beat us. That's what started all the fights with my mother. The verbal stuff started first, and then the physical. I was 12 years sober, man. I tell you what. I thought I had it going on. I really did think I had it going on. You know, I was doing all the right stuff. God opened my eyes again. So you got more work to do. Yeah. Yeah. It crushed me. It crushed me. It's like, you got to be kidding me. So I had to look deeper inside and find out more stuff about me. And I realized that I still had a lot of fear. I still had a lot of anger. There was still stuff that was buried so deep that I really had to be real and serious and dig to get it out. And it goes all the way back to the beginning. You see, I realized that I had an issue with expressing myself because I couldn't put words to the true feelings that were going on inside of me. So I couldn't really tell you what I needed to tell you to get the help that I really needed. So I had to put words to it. It wasn't just the anger. It was the shame. It was the fear. It was not feeling manly and masculine enough. All that stuff kept me from being the true man that I was and who I am today. You know, I tell people, I'm not a gentleman, I'm a gentleman. And there's a difference to that today. Oh, I'm a gentleman in opening the doors and, you know, being, have chivalry and stuff, but, you know, I was an angry individual. I fought my whole life. I can fight really well, by the way. All right. And that old part of me is still there, and it still comes out sideways sometimes. I still have character defects. I'm not an AA saint. If you listen to it in the words on how it works, it says none of us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. But I know some people that think they are. Yeah. And that's all right. I live and let live today. There are some people that I do not like in AA. I don't see any of them here tonight. I don't think they like me either. But that's okay. That's okay, you see, because I was told that if you like everybody in AA, you haven't gone to enough meetings. And I know for a fact that this is like any other organization. There's multitudes of personalities and ethnic backgrounds and all walks of life in these rooms today. And I don't know where you're at, and you don't know where I'm at unless you ask. Unless you ask. See? That's the help that I need. You know? So I look at that stuff, and I'm really blessed. I'm really grateful because, you know, in recovery, I mean, you know, my life has been twofold, and I'm really blessed with that. I really am. I lived on both sides of the street. I survived the other side of the tracks. I really have, and I am a survivor, just like everybody that's in this room tonight. You know, my brother Ricky died in 2005 of Agent Orange. My family and me have been distant for many, many years. Especially when I got in recovery, I'm the only one in recovery, so they don't get that part of me. And they've asked me when I came in, there was a pool in my family on when I was going to drink and drug again. It really was. My cousin, my nephew, told me that. He's like, Uncle Larry, everybody's got money on you. That's how I was, though. I was a liar and a thief, man. They knew I'm gonna stop drinking. Yeah, sure you are, but. Give him a couple months. But, you know, when he died in 2005. Died of Agent Orange in Vietnam. The last 2 years of his life, he got sober. And I carry his coin with me. It's a Vietnam vet and sobriety coin. I keep it with me all the time, anywhere I go. But we became brothers again. became brothers again. And I didn't realize it until one day I came to the VA hospital that he was in. I used to go up there every Friday and spend the weekend there. And one of the nurses, he was in late stages of the disease of cancer. The nurse came up and said, he's so happy when you come here. His whole attitude changes, and he gets more pep in his talk and in his life. And he's dying. The guy's dying. Okay. Every time I'd call, because he would call me and say, you coming? And I'm like, I'm on my way. He would hang up the phone and tell the nurses, my brother's coming. All right? And he would never tell me that. But I would wheel him out. He was blind at the end. And I quit smoking. I hadn't smoked in like 5 years. And I would go there, and he wanted to go outside and smoke. And I'd take him out, and next thing you know, I'm smoking with him. But he was blind. He was on a gurney. I'd wheel him down the hall outside in the parking lot. And try to stick a cigarette in his mouth. He couldn't see anything, and I explained the stars to him and what the night was like. And he died in my arms. My mother died in my arms. A couple of years later, my sister was murdered by her son, who was a crackhead. See, the disease is nasty, man. It's really nasty. All that stuff I hadn't drank. I haven't drank all through all that stuff. I was in 9/11. A lot of you know I'm a fireman. I was in 9/11. I didn't drink. I thought I was going to die, but I didn't drink. You know what I mean? I couldn't get to meetings for a long, long time. And I remember crawling through the pile and just thanking God, saying, please, you know, please let me get back to the top. Let me get out. You know what I mean? God was with me. I would be praying to God even when I wasn't around you guys. You know what I mean? That's what my life has been like. You know what I mean? And my children, I have two girls that, man, you women are tough. I used to make a joke of it, all right, when I was using. And it's chauvinistic, it really is. And I'm going to share it with you. I mean, it's really bad. You know, I used to say, you know, yeah, I went through 9 months of hormone hell, and now I'm going through a lifetime of PMS, you know, because I got nothing but women in my life. I'm blessed with women in my life. They've taught me a lot, man. They really have. Thank God for you women. But, my children today, they've my daughter, my youngest daughter was 3 years old when I quit drinking, and I had her, and this is amazing stuff. Here's another God thing, okay? I was staying with my buddy, we were using, and I'd get my daughter, my oldest daughter Emily was 3 years old. I would get her for one day on Saturday afternoon, spend a couple hours with her, and I was going down to the store, Grand Union. You know what Grand Union is, Bruce? Ain't much of them around anymore. It's like Kroger. And my buddy's like, I was going to get some stuff for the kid, you know, some soda and chips and shit, and spoil the hell out of her, and candy or whatever. And my buddy Jimmy goes, pick me up a 12-pack. Anyway, I'm trying not to drink. So she's in the cart, little basket I'm pushing. I grabbed a 12-pack and stuck it in the cart, and she looked at me and she goes, Daddy, you're not supposed to drink. She was 3 years old. Well, I said, I'm not drinking. Well, what's that? She knew. I stopped drinking. From the babes, from the mouths of babes, right? Isn't that what God said? From the mouths of babes. Yeah. So, there's another God thing. But anyways, those two girls in my life have their father, and they've been to, except the last couple of years since I moved south, they've been to every one of my celebrations in New York, and they've given me my coin every year. And they write me the most beautiful list cards that you can imagine. They bring tears to my eyes, and my heart just falls out of my chest, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it. It's true love is what it is. It's true love. And I didn't have true love. I never had true love. I didn't know what it felt like until I came in Alcoholics Anonymous. Love for another human being, love for a parent, love for a friend, love for somebody just sitting next to you that you don't even know. You know, I had no idea how to express any of that stuff. Learned it all here. Learned my life here. Learned how to be who I am today here. And, you know, I've been to a lot of different meetings, and I've spoken in a lot of different places, and I was living down here in Kentucky, and I'm gonna change up my story a little bit. See, and I also believe that, you know, my story on how I got here, my drunkalogue, has never changed. It is what it is. It's always going to be what it is, okay? But my story about recovery changes on a daily basis, because the longer I'm here, the more I learn and the more I can talk about. And I love talking about recovery. I talk all night long about recovery. When I talk about gratitude, I go on for hours, you know? But I moved down here 2.5 years ago to Kentucky. I was going to move to Tennessee, and buddy I played ball with in school, his brother went to my brother to Vietnam. We were on the same little league game team together. We were played on the same football team in high school together. Played hockey together. Grew up together. Lived in Shelbyville, Kentucky, and I decided that when my youngest Jody was going to college, I was moving south. And she went off to college, and I decided to lease out my house and move south. So I came down, and I come down and visit them all the time, ride the bike down, and I said, I'm going to go down to Tennessee and check out Tennessee. I want to move south somewhere. And he tried to talk me into moving to Shelbyville, and I'm like, I want to check out Tennessee. So I heard there's no taxes here. I don't like paying the government or anything, to tell you the truth, but anti-government. I'm a real patriot, but I'm anti-government. No shit. I mean, my father, my grandfather fought against the Kaiser. My father was with Patton, fought against Rommel. I had an uncle in the OSS, two uncles that were colonels, my two brothers in Vietnam, and then he got me. So I came down here, and I came to Nashville, actually. I drove around Nashville, went over to Knoxville, and I found Maryville, Tennessee. Maryville's a really nice little place. I like it because it's right next to the mountains, and you know, it reminded me a lot of New York. You know, it's a little warmer there too. So I drove back up to Shelbyville. I said, I think I'm gonna move to Maryville. I found a few houses down there, and he's like, man, you're always here. Why don't you just move here? And I said, all right, I'll be back in 30 days. He's like, get out of here. I said, I'll be back in 30 days. Oh, man of my word, I'm coming back. I was back in 30 days. Yeah. I went up, packed my house up, told my kids I'm moving south. My oldest daughter, she just had my grandson, and she's like, Dad, don't you want to stick around and see your grandson grow up? I said, I already had my kids. That's your family. I'm going to be grandfather. I'll come see him. He come see me. You know, that's the way it is. So I moved to Shelbyville, Kentucky. Big mistake. There's nothing but country there. I had freaking... They're growing tobacco next to me, and soybean up the street, and cows across the street. And man, I come home at night, and the deer are running out in front of the bike. I'm like, what the fuck? Driving 35 miles to Louisville every day and 35 miles back to go to a meeting. I'm like, what the hell am I doing here? This is country. Well, I wanted to move south, you know? Okay. So, I was told, a buddy of mine, Jimmy, a good friend of mine, he's like, oh, let's go to Nashville to this Roundup. I said, a Roundup? Yeah, Music City Roundup. It's an AA thing down there in Nashville. Let's go down there. I'm like, cool. It's at the Sheraton. I'm like, at the Sheraton? Okay, well, my sponsor in New York was the president of the Hotel Motel International Association. He went around the world to all these different hotels and got all the unions together and all these conventions and all this stuff, and he just retired. I said, let me give him a call. Maybe we can get a room really cheap, you know? So I call him up. He's like, yeah, call the general manager, tell him who you are, blah, 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 tell him you know me. I call him. I get this room for like $58. No, Well, hold on, my 55 was 2 years ago. I got it for $53 a night. Whatever year. Oh, no, wait a minute. The year you were born, it was. So I was born in 59. So I got the rooms for $59 a night. He's like, no shit. I'm like, give me three of them. So, yeah, I'll find somebody to film it. Don't worry. Give me three of those rooms. So we come down here, and I'm almost done. I'm getting to the end of my story here. So we come down here to the roundup, and this is where I need to put my sweet love Megan into my life, okay? Because she's part of my sobriety today. And I've been speaking lately, and I haven't added her into that part of the story yet. And I've been told that, you know, that's part of the story, so I got to put that in there. So I come down to the roundup, and I'm sitting with my buddy, and we're waiting for the speaker to happen, and I'm talking to him, and all of a sudden this girl sits on my lap. And I'm like, oh, this is a great roundup, man. It was Megan. And that's how we met. And I'm like, excuse me, but there's somebody sitting here. And it's not like I'm just some kind of little guy. You can't see me. I mean, I stand out in the room, you know what I mean? But shit, I can take up two chairs. But that's how we met, and she's been in my life ever since. And, you know, life is good. Life is really good in sobriety today. A lot of blessings, a lot of good recovery, a lot of good people, a lot of learning stuff still. You know, I moved down here. I moved to Kentucky. I had to leave my home group after 22 years. And all of my support network and my sponsor and, you know, my life in New York. And I moved to Kentucky and I had to start all over again. Find a home group, get another sponsor, get connected with AA, get a support network. I did all that. And then I moved to Nashville and I got to do it again. And believe me, it is a true refreshing awakening when you can do something like that. Because it brings you back to when you first came in. And all the struggles, all the fears come back. And I'm like, okay, I know all that. I'm recognizing this stuff today, okay? And that's what recovery has done for me. It has allowed me to learn, to listen, and to recognize what's going on in my life, whether it's through what I've gone through or what somebody else has gone through and what I've heard in these rooms that gives me the solutions to stay sober one day at a time. That's how it works. It's real simple. Pretty complicated when you first get here, though, because you don't know any of that stuff. You know, they're telling you, oh, do this step, go to the first step, write that one out, go get a sponsor, go, let's do the fourth step. Holy shit, man, you're overwhelming the hell out of me. Calm down a minute here, buddy. Let me get this stuff together, you know. But I stuck around long enough for the miracles to happen and for me to recognize them and to understand that I'm blessed with God's will, not mine. And he shows me on a daily basis what to do if I open my eyes and listen and learn. And he'll give me the words that I need to share my experience, strength, and hope, which I did here tonight. And I hope everybody got what they needed. Thank you.
It's not quite a circle, but it sure does represent what we can all do together that we can't do by ourselves. And that was funny for some reason. Who keeps us sober?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever.
Amen.
Keep coming back. It works if you work it.